This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ed Murphy joins me live in studio. He is an astronomer at the University of Virginia. Ed, it's good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Nice to see you, Coy.
Now, we have major news in the astronomy world from just yesterday. And that was astronomers announcing the discovery of a planet, the very first of its kind that we've seen in outer space. What's going on?
So this is a planet that was just discovered around a star, Gliese 581. And Gliese 581...
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah, that one. That's, in fact, you probably don't remember, but I think we've talked about this star before. This, to me right now, I think this is the most interesting star outside of our sun and our solar system. Because Gliese 581, we now know, has six planets going around it. And we've been gradually discovering these one by one over the last couple of years, but it's the latest planet that was announced that's really interesting. And so Gliese 581, first to set the scene, it's a sort of dim, cool red dwarf star. So it's somewhat smaller than our sun, not giving off as much energy every second as our sun is, but certainly within the possibility of the kinds of stars that could harbor interesting planets around them.
Yeah. Where is it? Like if we were looking to the night sky, a constellation? Or?
It's in the constellation of Libra, so it would be down in the southern sky. But this star is so faint that you can't see it with the naked eye. You need a telescope to see, or a pair of binoculars. If you knew exactly where to look, yeah, you could see this, but you can't see it with the naked eye.
20 light years away.
That's right. Right.
So not really in our celestial neighborhood, is it?
It is really. Actually, yeah, our next door neighbor, the nearest star to us is 4.5 light years away. So it's only 5 times further than the nearest star. And you have to remember that our part of the galaxy is fairly sparse. The average distance between stars is about 6 light years or so.
We're out in the sticks, aren't we?
That's right. So it's one of the closer star systems to our own.
Wow. So what was discovered by this star?
So the thing about finding planets around other stars is 15 years ago, if we were having this conversation, I would have had to say that the only planets we know about out there are the 9 planets going around our sun, and we don't know of other planets around other stars. We just think they're out there. We just can't see them because the planets are so faint and the stars are so bright. The analogy I like to use is trying to find a firefly that's flying around a bright searchlight that's shining right in your eyes. The star is the searchlight, and the planet is the little tiny firefly that's really hard to see in the presence of that searchlight. So astronomers have yet to develop techniques that would routinely allow us to photograph planets around other stars. We've been able to photograph a few planets around other stars, but not many. And that's not generally how we can discover that they're there. What we look for is the response of the star as the planet orbits around it. We've learned since we were little kids that the Earth is orbiting the sun. And then when you take a physics class, you find out that that's only partly true. It turns out the sun is also orbiting around the Earth. The sun wobbles around as the Earth goes around it every year. Since the sun is 330,000 times the mass of the Earth, its wobble is 330,000 times smaller. So we don't really notice that the sun is wobbling around. But if you get a big planet in orbit around a small star, as in this case, you can see that star wobbling back and forth. And we detect a shifting in the spectral lines or the colors of the star as the star moves towards us and then away from us and towards us and away from us. It's called the Doppler effect. And everyone's familiar with that. It's when a car is driving right towards you, the horn sounds different than when it's driving away from you. Because when the car is driving towards you, the waves are shifted to higher frequencies, the sound waves. And when it's moving away from you, they're shifted to lower frequencies. Light does the same thing. And so as the star gradually moves towards us and away from us and towards us and away from us, we see the lines in the star, the specific colors given off or absorbed by certain elements shifting back and forth.
And when it's going away, it's going to yellow and red.
That's right.
And when it's going towards you, it goes to blue?
It's shifted a little bit towards the blue. Now, because the shifts due to these planets are minuscule, they're tiny, they're literally measured in miles per hour. We're trying to measure a star that might be moving towards us and away from us and towards us and away from us, shifting back and forth by just a few miles per hour over a distance of 20 light years. It requires very, very high precision to do this. And that technique was developed in the mid-1990s.
So this is a really brand new thing.
It is.
Yeah, that scientists are working with.
In fact, I would have to argue that it may be one of the most exciting developments in astronomy in the 20th century, certainly the late 20th century, is this opening of a whole new branch of astronomy, which is studying the other planets that are out there in the universe. 15 years ago, we knew about 9 planets. Today, we know of over 400 planets going around other stars out there.
We are talking with Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia. So this planet around this this star, Gliese 581, Gliese 581.
Gliese 581.
Gliese 581. What do we know about it? What did they? What was the announcement yesterday?
So the announcement was that the planet is about 3 times the mass of the Earth. So it's a little bit, somewhat more massive than the Earth. It takes a little more than 36 days to orbit its parent star, which means it's about 7 times closer to its star than we are to the sun. But because Gliese 581 is a dim, cool red dwarf star, that means that it's in that perfect zone called the habitable zone, where liquid water could exist on the surface. If you imagine different regions of our solar system, you could move a planet so close to our sun that it's too hot for liquid water to exist. Or you could move it far enough away that it's too cold for liquid water to exist and all the water will be frozen. And there's this little magic zone. I call it the habitable zone. In the press, it's been called the Goldilocks zone, where everything's just right. The temperature's just right for liquid water to exist on the surface of the planet. And that's where astronomers have been looking to find a planet in that Goldilocks zone, that habitable zone, where liquid water could exist.
Now, in our own solar system, we're not the only planet in the Goldilocks zone, are we?
It depends on how conservative you want to draw the boundaries for the Goldilocks zone. So for a very conservative estimate of it, we are the only planet in the Goldilocks zone. If you're a little bit more if you're more liberal with drawing it, it includes Mars, but Mars is still on the outer edge of the habitable zone. And
I thought there were some moons, though, around Saturn and Jupiter that had liquid water.
They do have liquid water, but in those cases, there's something very special going on. In the case of Jupiter's largest moon, Europa, the heat that keeps that water liquid is actually coming from the tidal forces that Jupiter has with the moon, causing the moon to stress and flex and heat up the interior. It's not from the sun. That's exactly
gotcha.
Right. And that throws a whole different spin on this question of whether there's life in the universe, is that maybe you could have life further away from a star if it's driven not by photosynthesis or energy from the sun as we have on Earth, but if it's driven by tidal forces that are heating up some moon of a big planet. That's a separate issue.
Yeah. It's the same thing with life in the at the bottom of the ocean. We found
right.
life there living off of the heat coming out of the core
right.
of the Earth instead of from the sun.
Exactly. That was one of the big discoveries when they first sent submarines down to the deep ocean. They expected to be completely sterile down there with nothing living because light can't get down there. There's no photosynthesis operating. They didn't expect that anything could thrive at the very deepest part of the ocean. And when they went to these mid-ocean ridges where there's volcanic activity and there were these vents called black smokers, they found that there were bacteria living off of the minerals that are coming out of these black smokers. They live not by photosynthesis, but by chemosynthesis, using the chemicals that are coming out. And then, of course, other animals evolved to eat the bacteria, and then bigger animals evolved to eat the smaller animals. And there are these thriving communities around these black smokers in a place where the sun never gets down there.
So the takeaway from that is you might find life where you not only least expected it, but didn't expect it at all.
At all. That's exactly right. Yep. Life on Earth has certainly continued to surprise scientists in its ability to find even some of the most hostile environments. You find these hot springs, for example, where the temperature is almost at the boiling point of water, and you see bacteria thriving in those hot springs.
We're talking with Ed Murphy of the University of Virginia. So this planet that was announced, the discovery of this planet that was confirmed and announced yesterday by astronomers, Gliese 581, which is 20 light years away in the constellation of Libra. There's been a lot of speculation already. Is there life on this planet?
That's right. And here's where I think the reporting and even some of the statements by scientists cross the boundary from being responsible to, I think in some cases, irresponsible. So the facts are this. We know that it's 7 times closer to its star than our Earth is to the sun. We know it takes 36 days to go around. We know that it's a little bit more than 3 times the mass of our planet, which means it's probably about 30 to 50% larger than the Earth. So it's a somewhat bigger planet than the Earth is. That's where the facts end. this question of whether there's liquid water on the surface, there were some quotes that were coming out at the when this was first announced, that some scientists said that there's a 100% chance of probability that there's life there. And I thought that was a really irresponsible thing to say, because first of all, although it's in the habitable zone, we don't know that this planet has liquid water on the surface. We have not detected liquid water. The ability to detect liquid water is far beyond the technology we have right now. I don't know that it will even happen in my lifetime that we'll have the technology to look at a planet like that and determine for sure whether there's liquid water on the surface, let alone whether there is life or not.
Yeah.
So it's a very promising candidate, but by no means is this the end of the search. We have not, certainly have not found a planet that has life. We don't even know that we have found a planet that's good for life. We just know that it's in the right zone.
And we have found evidence of water on other planets besides our own.
That's right. In our solar system.
And on our moon as well.
That's right. So, but the water on our moon is just at the north and the south poles, and it's a minuscule amount of water on our moon. Certainly not interesting enough for the question of life. Mars and Jupiter's big moon Europa, which is one of Jupiter's icy moons, they have evidence of, in the case of Europa, substantial amounts of liquid water today, and in the case of Mars, substantial liquid water in the past. And of course, the reason I keep bringing up liquid water is we believe that's the universal ingredient that's required for life as we know it. When you're searching for life right now, astronomers are searching for the liquid water, because if you find liquid water, that's where life could develop, but not necessarily would.
We're honored to be talking with Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia. So let's pick up on that subject then and talk about the search for life. You called in the other day when Hall Spencer and I were talking on a Friday afternoon, having a good time and cutting up when we were talking. I don't remember exactly what we were talking about. Oh, we were talking about the sightings at Chicago and in Phoenix.
That's
and
right.
The UFOs, and about the conversation that I had with this woman who wrote a new book about UFOs. And you and I have spoken privately before about this subject. What are your thoughts on this? I know that you have, as a scientist, you have strong thoughts on this topic.
I do. I have very strong thoughts about UFOs and feelings about UFOs. And the answer to me ultimately comes down is that no one has provided me or any other scientist with a reasonable amount of evidence that beyond a shadow of a doubt indicates that we are being visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence that's controlling aircraft or spacecraft flying through our skies. The level of evidence hasn't even come close to establishing that that's what's going on.
So, but let's talk about some of these cases that people are familiar with, and that a lot of us have heard about, that sort of would lend some type of credence to some type of experience with UFOs. And let's start with the most recent that I know of, what happened in Chicago, where you had multiple witnesses, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here, multiple witnesses outside the airport videotaped saying they saw this thing take off and fly in a certain way that, you know, known aircraft cannot fly. And again, I'm not saying that these are aliens or little green men and women. I'm just saying that they are unknown flying spacecraft. So by definition, they're UFOs.
Right. And so what I would argue is that that both Carl Sagan and many other philosophers of science have told us is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And this question of whether we're being visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence, that's an extraordinary claim, that we are not only not alone in the universe, but that they're actually flying all the way here to visit us. I consider that an extraordinary claim, which to me requires an extraordinary amount of evidence. And so the Chicago UFO is a great one. For those that aren't familiar, it was a group of people at Chicago O'Hare Airport. They saw something hovering over Concourse C that was a round spinning metallic disc that then shot up. It was visible for a few minutes, and then it shot up into the sky. And as it went up into the sky, it left a hole in the sky, a hole in the clouds that persisted for a few minutes before the hole filled in and disappeared. It was first seen by someone who was backing an airplane out of one of the gates, and he looked up and he saw this thing in the sky, had mentioned it to the pilot and the co-pilot of the plane, who then looked up and thought they saw something. And then it was seen by other people who heard the communications over the radio and went outside and saw it. But altogether, it was a total of 12 employees, all who were employees of United Airlines, who all happened to be working on or around Concourse C at the time, that saw this thing. Now, that's all we have. So we have their testimony as to what they saw. Some of them weren't willing to come forward. Some of them described the spinning metallic disc that flew up into the sky. But the second question is, in my case then, is that extraordinary evidence? And the problem is there's a lot of problems with this sighting. The first one is it's Chicago O'Hare Airport. At that time of day, it was 4:30 in the afternoon. At that time of day, there must have been thousands of people outside looking up into the sky, not to mention all the professionals who are in charge of doing this in the control tower, other pilots, people who are constantly looking out for traffic in and around the biggest airport in the United States or busiest airport in the United States at the time. And yet only 12 employees of United Airlines, all working together in this one area of Concourse C, happened to see this thing.
But don't you think they saw something?
Oh, I think they saw something. The question is, what did they see? And does it rise to the level of extraordinary evidence? And, you know, I can't, it's like being a police officer trying to solve a murder. They can't solve every murder. And scientists, when we're looking at the facts later on, can't solve every mystery of what people saw in the sky. If we were there at the time, we might have a better idea, because unfortunately, over time, their reports get exaggerated, new details get filled in which weren't there originally in their original reports, and that confuses as what they saw. People start to confabulate, which is where they think they remember seeing something. And of course, we, you know, this is all well documented from the difficulty we have with eyewitness testimony at murders, where people are often incorrect in what they remember seeing and what they remember happened and how that's influenced by discussions they had afterwards. So my guess is what they saw is some kind of cloud in the sky, something that developed over the airport. It was a cloudy day that day. And there are a number of clouds that develop over mountains, for example, that take on beautiful round shapes. They often look like flying saucers that develop just as the air flows over some disturbance on the ground.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We're going to take a break here for local news and weather. And you can stay with us, right?
Yes.
Because I want to ask you about the Phoenix Lights. I want to ask you about that case of the Salt Lake City UFO. And then let's also talk about Betty and Barney Hill.
Okay.
Very famous, quote-unquote, abduction case that
That's
was
right.
made into a movie that a lot of folks remember. I remember seeing that as a kid, and it
That's
scared
right.
the heck out of me.
Yes.
My gosh. Anyway, we'll talk about these and more questions of the search for life beyond the stars with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We'll take a break for local news and get a weather update and continue this conversation in just a few minutes. This is Charlottesville Right Now. It's News Radio 1070 WINA. Let's rejoin our conversation with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy live in studio. The phone lines are open for your comments and questions at 977-1070. Ed, we were talking during the break about the difference between a true UFO, I see something in the sky and I don't know what it is, and little green men.
That's right.
So where are you on that spectrum? Do you believe that there actually are UFOs that are probably just us?
That's right.
And not aliens?
Exactly. So if we take the term unidentified flying object at face value, just looking at the words, I do believe people see lots of things in the sky that they can't identify. That doesn't mean if they had a trained scientist next to them that they couldn't identify what it is. So I do believe people see things in the sky that they don't understand. I just don't think that the evidence has even come close to showing us that we're being visited by an extraterrestrial civilization that's actually coming to visit us.
Yeah. Now, what about what happened in Phoenix back in the 90s? You had hundreds of people all in Phoenix and all across Arizona and down into Mexico who all claimed to have seen the same thing, this huge triangular-shaped craft moving very slowly from northwest to southeast across the state. And,
That's right.
you know, hundreds of people say they saw it and took pictures and lots of eyewitness accounts. How do you explain that?
So that one's a complicated one because there were actually two events. It was March of 1997, and the first thing that happened was people saw this large triangular-shaped object moving across the state. It was seen by dozens of witnesses. That made it onto the news, and then other people went outside later that evening, and they saw a number of lights hovering over the mountains just outside of Phoenix. And so there are those two separate events. The second one, those lights hovering over the mountains are almost certainly flares that were released by the Maryland National Guard, who happened to be out there on a range training that night, dropping these high-intensity flares. The rules operating at that Air Force base said that if they were out training with the flares on board, they weren't allowed to land with the flares still on the aircraft, so they had to dispose of them and they had to drop the flares, and they did and left this long string of lights. That's what most people think of when they think of the Phoenix Lights, is that string of lights seen over the mountains. And I think that one has been thoroughly shown to be Air National Guard just out there operating, dropping flares. The bigger question is this first thing that people saw, this triangular-shaped object. It was reported by lots of people from lots of different directions, which is what we would expect. There's lots of video of it, but some video and photographs of it, and it mostly just looks like a small group of lights moving through the sky. I think here there's a couple key witnesses that we need to consider, and one of whom is an amateur astronomer who happened to be out with his telescope that night and looked at it and saw that he could see the running lights of aircraft. It looked like a flight of aircraft flying in formation to him. And he actually, the reports that I have read, looked back at his mother who happened to be in the house, and he said, oh, it's just a bunch of airplanes flying in formation. Now, most other people reported seeing this triangular shape. If the airplanes were at high altitude, they might have filled in the dark space between these lights and assumed that there was something filling in that dark space when, in fact, it was just a bunch of individual lights on aircraft.
So this would be like military flying in formation at night doing some maneuvers.
Yeah, doing some kind of a formation flying at night.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been other cases like this. One that was seen in California a long time ago was aircraft refueling at night. People didn't understand what they were seeing when they saw these bright lights flying in very tight formation. And it turns out what they saw was a refueling operation where you actually do have aircraft, multiple aircraft, very close to one another.
Yeah, yeah.
At night, these refueling operations at night.
What about the UFO, the Salt Lake City case, which was during the day?
Yes.
I don't know when it was, but what's the significance of this, and what do we learn from this case?
So that's a great case because it was June 2007, and it was early in the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, and a whole bunch of different people reported seeing this big thing in the sky that they didn't understand. Now, this is exactly what we would expect if there was a real object flying in the skies over a major U.S. metropolitan area. That is, lots of people saw it from many different directions, but more importantly, people remembered that they had a camera with them. I recently asked my seminar class of 18 students how many of them were carrying a camera with them, and when I reminded them that a lot of cell phones have cameras, nearly every one of the 18 students was carrying a camera with them, essentially everywhere they go. So in Salt Lake City, this thing was photographed from many different directions. People reported that it was this huge silver thing in the sky, that it was moving erratically. But what's great about this case is we know exactly what it was. It was an amateur blimp maker. Just as there are people who build model airplanes and fly them, he was into building model blimps. And this particular one that he had built was about 30 feet long. He had launched it that morning, and the battery ran down, it lost power, and so he could no longer control it, and it just slowly drifted away on the wind. So we know precisely—
But his son wasn't on it or anything.
No, no,
I mean, this
that's
isn't
right.
Blimp boy. This is,
no, this was
this
just
is something else.
This was just a guy, he you know, like people who build model airplanes and fly model airplanes, he liked to build model blimps and fly them, but he lost control of this one. But this is a perfect example, I think, where the Chicago O'Hare UFO case falls down. This one was photographed by lots of people. They went outside, they saw this thing, they got their cameras out, and they photographed it. Yet at O'Hare Airport, there were thousands of people outside at that moment, and this big thing hovering over the airport, and no one took a photograph of it. You know, at least none of the photographs that we've seen.
They got them with one of those ray guns or something where people could...
We don't know. It's an interesting question. There's something else that very, very rarely happens, and it's quite tragic when it happens, which is a major airliner crashing. But a lot of times when an airliner goes down, someone gets a picture of it in the process of crashing. When the Concorde crashed a few years ago, you'll remember it was photographed on the runway. It was photographed in the air. It was photographed as it was crashing. If something real is happening in the sky, there are so many cameras out there today that I can't believe we don't get lots and lots of great pictures of these things. And if someone, if we had hundreds of people taking a picture of some giant triangular-shaped object over a major U.S. city, that might rise to the level of extraordinary proof, but we've never gotten that.
We are talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy, and Gary is on Charlotte Hill right now. Gary, go right ahead.
Hey, thanks a lot, Coy. If this professor was... the professor of one of my children, I would be thrilled if they were interested in astronomy. My question is basically, Ed is so excited about his field. I would really like to know a little bit more about him and his childhood when he caught this astronomy bug, and if there was some teacher or some mentor that really was the fire for him. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Gary, thank you so much for the call. When did you get turned on to all this stuff?
you know, when I advise my students at UVA, sometimes they say, how did you figure out what you wanted to be? Because they're still struggling with this question. And for me, it was easy. I've known since I was a little kid that I wanted to be an astronomer. Although when I was a kid, it was astronomer, astronaut were confused with one another. I didn't know the difference between the two. But I think the important thing for me was in high school, I had good science teachers. And then the real key for me was my senior year of high school. I took a class at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago where I was growing up, and it was it was a class for high school students interested in astronomy. And up until this point, I had no idea that you could be an astronomer for a career. My mother was a nurse, my father was a truck driver. I didn't know that you could do this and make a living at it. I thought astronomy was something people did at night in their backyards, and then they went out and they had a real job during the day.
Did you have the telescope as a kid?
I did. I had a telescope. My father bought me my first telescope, a little small telescope. It was the first one. I saw the rings of Saturn in my backyard. Was so excited. I got all the neighbors to come over and see the rings of Saturn.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Hey, Gary, thank you for the call. Let me ask you about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. A lot of us have seen that movie.
Yep.
I saw it as a kid and it scared the heck out of me. So what's your take on that? Because a lot of people not only say they see things and swear they saw it,
yep.
There's some people who say they've actually been abducted and they just swear up and down and they pass polygraphs and they go, you know, under hypnosis and they still tell this story about something that happened to them.
That's right. And the Barney and Betty Hill case is still held up as being one of the best. And so this is a case that happened back in the late 1960s. They were driving home to New Hampshire from a vacation in Quebec. And during the way, they saw a bright light in the sky. They stopped to examine it. And Barney got out and said with binoculars, he saw a number of humanoid figures in the light. And then there's a very long story behind it. But then they got home, they had strange feelings, and they also had lost some time. About 2 to 3 hours of their life were missing. They don't remember. They got home at 7 a.m. and realized they should have gotten home about 4 a.m. and thought, where did these extra hours go? What detained them for so long? And over time, they had had lots of interviews with UFO experts, but about 3 years, 2 or 3 years after the experience, they went under hypnosis. And under hypnosis, lots and lots of details came out as to what happened. And in the hypnosis, we learned that they were taken aboard the spacecraft. They were medically probed while they were on the spacecraft. Betty remembers seeing a star map that she was able to reproduce later on. And that they had seen all these things. So at that point, they believed they had been taken on the spacecraft. Now, that's the story that we're always told. The problem is the story starts to fall apart. The first thing to know is the hypnosis didn't happen for a few years. And in those few years, Betty was reading extensively about UFOs and about aliens and was talking quite extensively with UFO experts at the time. And she was writing all this down. And her husband was constantly hearing this. So people have often said that it's surprising that under hypnosis that their two stories matched so well. But it might not be so surprising if it took a few years before they had the hypnosis. And in the meantime, she was constantly talking about it and writing about it and dreaming about it. And she and her husband had many years of exposure to the story before they underwent hypnosis. The second thing is hypnosis is not a guaranteed way to bring out the truth. It's not admissible in a court of law, for example, because people are very suggestive in hypnosis, and they have a hard time judging the difference between reality and fantasy under hypnosis. And it's very likely that what happened is that these years of leading up to the hypnosis is when this story came together.
So where were they during the night then? Why didn't they get home at 4?
You know, the thing is that all those details didn't come out till so much later. We don't know exactly what time they got home.
They
may have taken longer to get home, but it may have been because they had stopped and gotten out and looked at the UFO. They may have traveled slower than usual. We don't know exactly what happened that night. But unfortunately, all the pieces of evidence they're lacking ultimately when you get down to it into proving that they were abducted by this UFO.
Scary movie though.
It was a very scary movie, and I will point out that if it's true, if they really are coming and snatching people, as Harvard psychologist John Mack indicated, that hundreds of thousands of people are being snatched out of their beds and taken aboard UFOs at night, that really is scary.
Yeah.
But if hundreds of thousands of people were being abducted every year, I would hope that someone would get a good picture of just one.
We're talking with Ed Murphy, and Lou is on the line. Lou, go right ahead.
Yes, hello there. One of the theories that people just absolutely love to latch on to, you know, these conspiratorial theories and, you know, the government, you know, they've got aliens and alien technology locked away in secret hangars, and they really know that they live among us, but they're not going to tell us because we're all going to panic. And what people don't stop to realize is, hey, nobody can keep a secret these days. There are no secrets. If this was occurring, somebody would have said something.
You know, I agree with that completely, that a secret.
And that's
this
your point
big,
about the cameras.
Yeah, if, that's you right. Know. Yeah. Not only that, but even if the government did have something, keeping a secret this big is a really difficult thing to do. And I have a hard time believing that. I mean, this would be the biggest secret the government has ever kept. And it's hard to believe they could keep a wrap on it, especially when, you know, years later, of course, it turns out that during the development of the hydrogen bomb, there was lots of spying going on, lots of material made its way overseas. I have a hard time believing that you could keep a lid on this thing for so long and not have word get out. The technology is a really good one, too. People claim that the government has this and they're mining these alien spacecraft for technology that will be used in future weapons. But when you look at our weapons today, there's nothing in there that hasn't slowly developed over the last 50 years. You can take every military weapon we have, every piece of technology we have, and trace the history of it all the way back, because the vast majority of this work is civilian work. They might develop a camera that's a little bit better than the camera that you and I have, but ultimately it's the same technology. They just were able to spend a lot more and do a much better job at fabricating it. But there's no huge leap that seemed to come out of nowhere.
Lou, thank you for the call. We got a line open at 977-1070. We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. What is it you think that a lot of people out there really want to believe, though, that there's some truth to this stuff? Is that just the perennial search for meaning in a postmodern world?
I think it is. I think a lot of people want to believe we're out there. I think a lot of people just don't know what they're seeing in the sky. That by far the biggest thing that's reported is UFOs or the planets Venus and Jupiter. If you go out tonight, look in the southeast right after sunset, as soon as it gets dark, you will see the brilliant planet Jupiter hanging up there in the southeast. It'll be due south right around midnight, a little
before midnight. I saw it last night when I was running. It was beautiful.
It's beautiful. And that is Jupiter and Venus are the two most reported objects in the sky as being UFOs. And those reports are really interesting because they will say that they saw a bright light in the west just after sunset. And as an astronomer, we'll know that Venus was up there that night. They'll say it was changing colors, it was moving around erratically, and you say, okay, well, Venus was also up there. Where was it in relation to Venus? And they'll admit, oh, I didn't see Venus, but I saw this really bright light in the western sky. And right away, that's a signal that what they were seeing was Venus. And it's interesting how the human mind fills in details that weren't there.
Makes it move
makes
and
it
change
move.
Colors.
Exactly. And that probably comes from the predisposition. People believe that there are UFOs visiting us. And when they see a bright light that they don't understand, the first thing that leaps to mind is that it must be a UFO. And then in their mind, it behaves like a UFO. But if you had an astronomer standing next to you, they'd say, oh, no, that's the planet Venus.
Amazing. Paul is with us. Paul is on Charlottesville right now. You go right ahead.
Yes, hello. I come from a different branch of science and engineering, and we always do different studies to tell exactly how well we know things. When astronomers talk, they always seem to indicate that they know that this planet exists, or they know this thing. To what accuracy do astronomers know this information? And there must be some errors in their calculations sometimes that might mean that a planet that we think exists actually is something else.
No, that's a very good question. In fact, all of these scientific studies have error bars on them, and they have uncertainty associated with them. And when I'm here with Coy, I tend not to quote all of those things.
Because you'll confuse me.
Well, confuse me. And in some cases, they're in fact extremely important. And in some cases, the errors are so small that that we don't worry about it when we're commonly discussing it. So as for the existence of extrasolar planets, the existence of those planets is extremely well established in the vast majority of these cases. Now, this new one that we were just talking about that's possibly in the habitable zone, I think the evidence for the planet being there is quite good. I think the evidence for it being habitable is completely unknown at this point. You know, it's in the right zone. And the habitable zone is relatively easy to determine for a star. You just determine from, you know, how much energy the star is giving off per second. So you simply back off from the star and try and figure out where the temperature of a planet will no longer be too hot for liquid water to exist and then where it'll be too cold and it'll be frozen. So the habitable zone boundaries we can calculate with a reasonable amount of accuracy. And we this planet looks like it's in that habitable zone. But for the other questions as to whether there is water, that's a complete unknown.
Paul, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 977-1070. Ed, before we let you go, we want to touch on the recent news from NASA. They finally got some money, and they finally have some direction. This has been up in the air. We've been talking to you for months, and it's just been up in the air.
That's right.
We didn't know what was going to happen with NASA, but now we do.
Yeah, exactly. Last week, Congress, the Senate finally adopted, or some the House finally adopted the Senate's authorization bill for NASA, which gives NASA its plan for the next few years and how NASA should proceed. Just to remind the listeners what was going on, the president had proposed a plan for NASA. Many congressmen didn't like the plan. And many members of Congress were arguing vehemently against it, as was a former NASA administrator, Michael Griffin. And this has been playing out in the press, and they've been battling back and forth as to what direction NASA should take. So the Senate was finally able to hammer out a compromise bill that went to the House, and it looked like this bill wasn't going to proceed in the House, but the House finally realized that they needed to do something. And even though the House felt it was a less than perfect bill, they passed it. And so NASA has an authorization bill, which you know is different than the appropriations bill. This doesn't actually allocate the money, but it does give NASA a direction in which to go. Now it will be up to the allocation committees to decide how much funding NASA should get for all of these things.
So the authorization says, this is what we want you to do, and then you got to do appropriations to give the money to do it.
That's right, exactly.
That doesn't always come, but...
No, that's right. And in fact, as we all know, the appropriators, when they write the appropriations bills, can add riders and make changes to what the authorization bill said.
Yeah.
And so it may change as we go down the road.
So give us some idea of some of the specifics that are in the latest authorization that... where's NASA going?
The big news is that the Constellation program, which was the program that President Bush had started to build a new manned rocket, a rocket for human spaceflight, is now officially canceled. It will not proceed. The Constellation program is essentially over. We're going to continue to retire the space shuttle, but they did add one more flight next year. So there are now three flights of the space shuttle left. The next upcoming flight is on November 1st. Then there will be one in the spring and then one in June of 2011.
And then that's it.
That's it. That'll be the last flight of the space shuttle. The International Space Station has now been officially extended till 2020, so we will continue sending astronauts and doing work up there for 10 more years.
More good money after bad, right?
Well, it you know, now that it's built, some people are arguing that
and has new toilets
and has new toilets and the life support system seems to be working right now. Some people are arguing that we should utilize it now that we have spent the money to build it. I still haven't seen what I think would be a very clear plan for getting a huge amount of science out of the International Space Station in the next 10 years.
In software terms, there's never been a killer app
for
the space station.
No, that's exactly right. Yes, and in fact, an article that I read just today is that the Japanese the Japanese group that runs a module on the International Space Station has space for rent, and they can't even rent all the space they have. Companies aren't interested in renting scientific space to carry out experiments at the prices that it costs.
So after the space shuttle, what's in the authorization plan? I mean, is there more authorization for like what we've seen to Mars, like rovers and things?
The science budget is a separate issue. This was about the human spaceflight program, what NASA will do with human spaceflight. We can talk about science in a minute, but what is coming is that there is money in the bill for the commercialization of space. That is, NASA paying commercial companies to build and launch our astronauts to the International Space Station for us. And there's money in there to encourage companies to develop that capability as soon as possible. And then, oddly, the Senate also dictated to NASA that they need to build a new heavy-lift launch vehicle that can lift between 70 and 100 metric tons up into orbit. Now, this is a much bigger rocket than I would argue what we need right now. And the reason for that rocket isn't quite clear.
Interesting. Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia. Ed, thank you so much. Always look forward to you stopping by.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.